All right, now let's talk to Elise Glink from Think Glink Media. Elise, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Oh, just can't believe we're at the end of the year, John.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. It's been a wild, topsy-turvy year. It's not all been bad, but it's certainly been rollicking, and I'm ready for 26. How about you?
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to put this year in the rearview mirror.
I think a lot of people feel that way. Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media. She follows, among other things, real estate most closely. You and I have talked about this before, and one number that I still have trouble getting my head around is that the typical first-time home buyer is now around 40 years old. Am I reading that right?
You are. That was this year's notice from the National Association of Realtors, and I think it took a lot of people by surprise. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that first-time home buyers make up just 21% of all home purchases. That's a historic low. So the number would go up, right, when the number of first-time home buyers anyway is just so small. But it's certainly down. It's up. The average age of first-time homebuyers is up simply because so many young people today can't afford to buy. They don't have the down payment required. Their jobs don't pay enough. Interest rates are higher. And, we've talked about this, it's up from the late 20s. Back in the 1980s, the typical first-time buyer was in their, 26, 27 years old. Today it's 40.
Yeah. If you ask me what's the number one thing about that, high cost of housing is maybe it, but even that probably is affected by the interest rates, isn't it? Is it the interest rates which are keeping younger people from buying homes?
It's a couple of things. When you look back across this year, one of the things that jumps out to me is not that interest rates are so high, because they're, 6.5%, 7%, even 7%. I mean, you and I have talked about how my first house, I paid 11.75%, and I was delighted when it went down to just 8%. So it's not really that. In my mind, it's this combination of needing the down payment, the high price of the houses, and just not that many houses out there to buy. So when you buy something and you are able to actually close in that deal, there's a huge percentage of buyers who are somewhat dissatisfied with the houses they've had to settle for. Mm. And I think that's, to me, is a number that we're just going to see going forward until we solve the one big problem, which is that we're about 5 to 6 million homes short in this country.
Well, I guess all these things are tied together, but is there a little of that? That is, I wonder if the first-time home buyers, these people in their 30s, maybe even 20s, could buy a house, but they don't want to buy that house. They want a nicer house. And I wonder if they fully appreciate the concept of building equity in any house. The market rises, you fix the house up, now you've got a little more cash, and that's the way it goes. The first house you buy is by no stretch hopefully going to be the last house.
Yeah, this is the HGTV-ism of the world, right? Everybody watches how in 30 minutes these television hosts on the HGTV network, where they turn these, derelict-looking teardowns into really beautiful, gorgeous, move-in-here-today-and-don't-make-any-changes kind of houses. And I think we've all been conditioned over the last 20 years to see the houses we buy, that they're going to look that way. So you've seen in real estate just over 20 years, the whole idea that you're going to stage your house, that came out of nowhere. It came from HGTV, and today that's a huge industry. And not only are we seeing professional stagers come in, but now with AI, we're seeing AI come in, and you can virtually stage your houses so that they look fabulous until the moment you walk through the door, if you actually do that and you see what it really looks like.
And if it's not all that you'd hoped and dreamed, still, I don't want anybody to buy a house that they don't want, but I just think you need to set your expectations. Be realistic if you're a first-time home buyer.
Yeah, I'm just going to say this, and I've said it for years. I've written it in all of my books. the younger you are when you buy your first home, the wealthier you'll be later in life. And it's for all these things that you and I talk about, right? Every single mortgage payment builds equity. It's money in the bank that you're never going to miss because you're busy paying for your life. And so when people get to the end of a mortgage or they sell and they're able to trade up, they end up with a pot of cash, the equity that they can use to apply to the next home, which is probably going to be bigger and better in many different ways. Or they'll take that cash and they'll use it to fix up the next house they buy. And that's really been the American way of building wealth for everybody but the very wealthy, right? You put in your time and you pay your bills and that house appreciates and you pay it down, the mortgage, and you end up with a pot of cash.
There's another statistic you noticed, and that is who's most likely to be a first-time home buyer, a single guy or a single gal? And I want you to comment a little bit on that trend. This is another eye-popping number from Elise Glink. We'll pick it up here in a minute. This is the Noon Business Lunch on WGN. I'm John Williams. Mondays, we talk to Elise Glink from Think Glink Media. She follows real estate, among other things. A moment ago, you said that the average new home buyer is almost 40 years old now. And that, here's just another fun fact, single women are outpacing single men in the housing market, right?
Yeah, that's the truth. For this year, single women represent about 24% of first-time buyers compared to just 8% for single men, John. And the median age for single women, about 38 to 40. For single men, they're a lot younger, 33 to 34. And women are achieving homeownership despite earning less, about $70,600 compared to $87,500 for single men. So some differences in between the sexes or genders. I'm not sure which that is these days, but single women are outpacing single men for housing.
So single women outpacing men. Women, single women, 24% are first-time buyers. Single men, 8. That's 32. So 68% of first-time home buyers are couples then, not single men or women.
Yeah, they're couples or they're partners, non-romantic partners who buy houses together. And we're seeing that in a number of ways play out, which is kind of interesting. We're seeing it as parents buying with maybe one of their children. So it's two incomes that way, or it might be two non-romantic, just friends buying a house together for the first time, and they live in, let's say, a two flat.
Yeah.
So a lot of different ways that people are rethinking. And in fact, that's one of the things that I call out in my list of things you might want to think about doing this year, is think about or rethink how you think about a first-time home, right? It doesn't have to be like the magical, beautiful HGTV single-family house with a garden and a picket fence. It might be a two or three flat, or you might go in with your parents to buy something, or your in-laws.
Well, I wonder, I'll bet a lot, I don't know. I wonder if a lot of adult parents are co-signing on mortgages for their kids so they can stop paying rent or get out of the basement. This listener said, my son is in his 40s and has great credit, $20,000 down, but he only makes $60,000 a year. He can only afford then a house $230,000 to $240,000, and there's not much available.
Yeah, that's the problem we talked about earlier, where you're missing 5 to 6 million homes out there, and a big portion of those are homes that first-time buyers would be able to afford.
Well, what's a new home cost these days on average?
And median home price for a new house is something like $450,000. In the Chicago metropolitan area, it's less. It's a little under $400,000 for a new house. But that said, the median price of a house in the metro area here is still in the low 300,000s, which means that there are homes that are selling for less. So her son might be able to afford a condo, for example, at $250,000. But that, again, is where your interest rate question comes into play, because when interest rates were 2.5% or 3%, which is still recent memory for a lot of people, you'd be able to buy four times your income or five times your income, and this guy would have probably been able to get over $300,000 with that.
This listener says, these kids need to lower their expectations. They want 3,000 square foot houses, not the 1,600 square foot like their parents started when they worked for 20 years to afford larger houses. Signed, the voice of experience. Okay, boomers, let's not pretend that what the market is like today is what it was like when we were first buying. And I know, I think all, you did it, and I'm ready to do it, too. I could tell you what my first house was and how high the interest rate was, and we scraped by and we made it. I'm not sure that it's apples to apples, though, Elise. I think it is genuinely harder to get into a house now than it was back then.
I think it is, but I got to say, I didn't earn $60,000 for a long, long time. You know, my first job getting out of college, my first full-time job paid about $15,000 a year. I worked as an assistant at a book publisher while I got my freelance writing business going. So I think there's some differences, you know, there too. Yes, houses were far less expensive 30 years ago, but our incomes were less as well. Now, that doesn't mean, and I don't want to insinuate that we have kept up. Those incomes, while they're a lot higher today, are not anywhere that where they would have been had inflation really kept pace with our income, or I should say that the reverse way, our incomes had kept pace with inflation. But I do agree with that listener that there are these outsized expectations of what that house is going to look like. But really, we're just missing a whole bunch of entry-level housing in this country.
That's it.
And that's the problem, because it's not cost effective and profitable enough for the companies that we have that build these new homes to build the $200,000 house when they can do the same amount of work and build a $500,000 house and sell those out.
I just have the feeling that income has not kept up with inflation compared to 40 years ago, say, or 30 years ago, or 50 years ago. I wasn't buying a house 50 years ago, but you take my point. And I also, and you can't deny that, first of all, cars are stupid expensive. But number two, the media costs are so much more expensive now. The phone in your pocket is $1,000. You didn't have a phone once upon a time like that. You had a couple of landlines. You did not have internet accounts. You did not have platforms to watch TV shows on. And I'm not expecting these young people to live in a hole, so I don't think it's a foolish expense to be talking on your phone, looking at a computer, and sometimes watching Netflix. Well, that's a few hundred dollars a month right there. And student loans are more pressing on young people now than they used to be.
Yeah, there's no question that the expenses that people have today are in large part greater as a percentage of their income than they were, and that things like student loans really have, you know, $1.8 trillion in student loans out there, and those are certainly not at 2%. We're seeing those at a lot higher price. And so there's some very real reasons, you know, technical reasons why you can't buy, and there's a lot of reasons why we don't have more housing stock. But that's the problem with real estate today, is that these things have all converged at the exact same time, and it's hard to see how we're going to either build more property, bring down the interest rate, also, you know, improve the buying power, have everything all happen at the same time. But I sure hope for 2026 it's going to happen.
630 says, my daughter's 25. I'm proud to say she just bought her first home. Yeah, I'm sure you are, and I'm happy for her. I do wonder about the circumstances of that. Did you help underwrite the down payment? Are you signed on the mortgage? Where was the house? Do they live in the metropolitan Chicago area, which is a lot harder to find a entry-level house than if you live in Peoria or out where I live sometimes in Ottawa? Or, you know, if location matters a lot about this conversation.
Location, location, location. It certainly does. But the, you know, I'll just say, for those of you who are helping your children, you're in good company, because over 64-65% of parents are helping their adult children pay their bills. And most of those go to pay things like, you know, your debt and also your grocery bills. So, and they're paying like $500-$700 a month per kid. So there's certainly a lot of wealth being moved around in order to help kids get their find their feet in today's world.
John, you're not mentioning the rise of property taxes. Another listener said, please mention the problem of these home buyers who buy up the starter homes or fixer uppers. I'm bombarded with mailings from these people, and it's nuts. Yeah, I don't know if it's real or not, but I've been getting texts lately from somebody saying, we'd like to talk to you about your house. I'm like, I don't even think you're real, and I'm not going to sell. What advice do you have then for maybe the parents of these young potential home buyers or the buyers themselves?
Yeah, I mean, if you can, help them put together their down payment. The larger the down payment, the less of a mortgage they'll have to take. If you need to co-sign for them, be aware that that will impact your credit if they stop paying that bill and could prevent you from doing some of the things you want to do. And then finally, parents, please remember, retirement is in the near view mirror for you, not the rear view mirror, generally speaking. And you want to make sure your retirement is secure, because nobody will lend you a dime for retirement. And eventually your kids will be able to borrow to buy their dream house.
You also said raise your credit score. There are ways to do that. And also, I think this is just an interesting line, learn everything about first-time buyer programs. I only know that because my nephew was looking into buying a home for the first time, and there was a program that he would qualify for in Chicago, and it's very advantageous if you know the program and qualify to buy a house or a condo. It's not just go to the bank and borrow with 10 or 20% down. There are some programs out there. You got to do some digging.
Yeah, you really do. If you sign up for my Substack, glink.substack.com, it's free. I'll be putting up this list of things that you might want to do for if you're buying a house or selling a house this week and next week. They're all going to come out, and you'll get a chance to see it. And it includes the links and what you need to put into your search engine in order to find those special programs. So I'll be putting that up for everybody, John.
Okay, there's some reading for you. Glink.substack.com. Glink.substack.com. Thanks, Elise. Nice to talk to you. Have a great new year.
Hey, you too, John. Thank you.
12:36 on the Noon Business Lunch, about our conversation with Elise Glink and how first-time homebuyers, younger people, but people as old as 40 now, are having trouble buying that first home. Hey, John Williams, was there a time for boomers that mortgage interest was written off against your federal taxes? Yes, there was. John, about our daughter who bought a house at the age of 25, she's in Aurora. She did it almost on her own. We gifted her some money for the down payment. John, we didn't charge our kids rent. That's how they were able to buy their house. But we told them we expected them to be out, or at least to be having an exit plan by the age of 25. My son's in the Navy. Our daughter bought a condo at the age of 24. And this listener said, you're also not talking about corporate America buying up starter homes and turning them into rentals, therefore reducing the options for first-time buyers. I thought we mentioned that. If we didn't, that's 100% true, and that complicates it even more. Okay, now let's talk to Elliot Richardson, the president and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Elliot, welcome back to the show. How are you?
John, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well. I hope your holidays were good.
Yeah, likewise, likewise.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys do. We've talked before, but for those who don't know the Small Business Advocacy Council, what's that?
You know, the SBAC is an organization made up of folks who truly care about the small business community. We push forward legislation on a city, state, and federal level that is, again, laser focused on empowering and supporting small businesses and local communities. And we do that through proactive legislative initiatives, whether it is reducing red tape for small businesses, trying to level the playing field as it pertains to things like tax incentives, stabilizing health insurance premiums. There are so many issues facing small businesses right now, John, so many challenges, and we just try to do as much as we possibly can while creating a community where small business owners and entrepreneurs and professionals can collaborate and communicate and really, push forward a positive agenda together.
So are you for Chicago businesses, Northern Illinois? What's the region that you cover?
You know, John, we really work on issues that impact businesses across the entire state. There is a degree of work that we do for Chicago businesses. We work with a lot of chambers of commerce and place-based organizations in Chicago. So I would say, you know, a good portion of our work is focused on the Chicagoland area, but certainly the initiatives that we're pushing forward in Springfield will help businesses across the state and entrepreneurs across the state. And, you know, some of that has to be done at a federal level as well. So, yeah, I mean, we're working for all businesses in Illinois, and some of that pertains to our city.
Do you have strong feelings about the budget that the city council passed in Chicago?
That is a loaded question. Well, it is, you know, there was a budget that was passed. And we think that, you know, the process was pretty remarkable, John. The mayor proposed a budget that is not the budget that ultimately passed. There was something called an alternative budget, which got past the finish line. It does not look like the mayor is going to veto that budget. It also doesn't seem like he's going to sign it. It looks like it's just going to go into effect and be implemented.
Yeah, he did not. I mean, maybe it goes into effect January 1st, but I don't expect him to pick up the pen between now and then. He's decidedly not signed it.
Yeah, and that's what his team's saying. So, you know, I think there was a $1 billion budget shortfall that had to try to be, you know, dealt with, and these Alder people that came together did it in the way that they felt was best. There are a lot of new, you know, taxes in the budget. There are some other ways by which they're trying to raise revenue, such as selling city debt, doing some other things. You know, you could kind of go point by point by a lot of the things that are in this budget. We were disappointed in some ways. We were disappointed to see regulated business license fees quadruple. That really has a disproportionate impact on small businesses, on communities that are really supported by businesses that are small and trying to grow. We saw limited business licenses double. We saw fines double. We saw the annual food inspection fee double. And that's going to impact restaurants every year. So, you know, unfortunately, it seemed like some of the burden was put on small businesses. And while we pushed back pretty significantly, and some alders certainly discussed the impact these increased fees and fines are going to have on the small business community, they were in every version of the budget and they were ultimately passed. So I would say, you know, do we have strong feelings about the budget? We're glad there is a budget. We're glad that there was not a government shutdown in the city of Chicago. We think that the alders did the best that they could to put something forward. We're disappointed with the increased fines and fees.
Bet you would have loved the head tax.
Well, not, you know, the folks that we talked with were not in favor of that tax.
That was sarcasm on my point, by the way.
Okay, great. Well, John, I should know that already. well, you know, it's pretty interesting that you say that because, you know, being the Small Business Advocacy Council, when this concept of a head tax was proposed at the very beginning, I mean, to be frank, I wasn't sure how people would feel about it, right, in the small business community.
Because it won't affect that many small businesses.
Not directly. So we really had to listen to the people that rely on us, listen to our constituency, listen to folks from chambers of commerce, from small businesses. But as this thing was bantered about, it became clear it was not popular among the small business community. They were concerned about what the trickle-down impact of that
right.
would be. And by
right.
that, I mean, yeah, I mean, so if bigger companies don't expand or they move out or they keep their employees home an extra day, because the thing about that head tax is a worker had to be in the city at least 50% of the time. And we know the issues that the Loop is having, right, in terms of bringing people in. And that's not just reserved to the Loop. The head tax was not popular. You know, we took a position that it was not a good idea. It should not be in the budget. So it was interesting to see all of that play out, John, really over the course of the, you know, the 6 weeks or so that these budget negotiations were going on.
Brandon Johnson hasn't given up on that. He's had to concede this time, but he still thinks that's a fight worth fighting. And you mentioned all of the different fees that small businesses have to pay for licenses, et cetera. You and I have spoken about that before, and you think that there are too many to begin with, let alone that the cost of them should be doubled. For instance, if you're a barber or something like that, it seems to me like there's a hairstylist. There's a number of licenses and regulations that you have to abide by and costs that go with them that just seem unnecessary. Am I remembering that right?
Well, absolutely. And you're also dealing with this sort of maze of city fees and state fees. So when you take a barber, for instance, right? I mean, the problem that a individual who just wants to become a barber and make a living has in the state of Illinois is, I'm not sure I have the stats at the top tip of my tongue, but it's something like you have to do a remarkable number of hours in terms of training to become a barber, and that you can spend $10,000 on that training simply to get your barber's license, right? That shuts people out. And some of the things that are in this budget, right? So like quadrupling the regulated business license from $250 to $1,000, and that has to be renewed every 2 years, or doubling the annual food inspection fees for restaurants. That sort of piles on, John. And then on top of that, like you've heard a lot about the cloud computing tax, right? And, you know, that really applies to certain businesses, whether or not they're using cloud computing services or they're a restaurant that's been in business for a certain period of time and they're leasing their ice machine or their ovens. That tax increased from 11% to 15%.
Wait a minute. What does an ice machine have to do with? Are you saying that's cloud computing? What's the tax on an ice machine?
Yeah, so it's the personal property lease transaction tax, okay? Oftentimes, that's referred to as the cloud tax in Chicago because it also applies to, like, cloud computing software, right? You know, and I'm certainly not the expert on cloud computing software, but from things that you lease, right? So if you're a professional services company, you lease a lot of your products, you know, your management system, so on and so forth. I don't think a lot of people realize that also applies to physical things that you lease, right? So, you know, if you're a bar or if you're a restaurant or if you're an establishment that leases things and you fall within the confines, which is a certain amount of time in business and a certain amount of revenue, then you're going to be taxed on that ice machine that you lease, and that's gone up in this last budget. So, you know, to your point about the different fees and fines and regulations, look, you got to fund the government, that's for sure, right? But fees and fines should correlate to what it actually costs to administer getting licenses out and doing those types of things. And they should not unnecessarily shut people out from opening a business. You know, that's a position we consistently take.
Yeah, and I don't blame you for taking that. I think a lot of times we're frustrated when we see that there is a tax or fee associated with something, and yet the money doesn't have, but that doesn't have anything to do with where the money goes, right? Like, it's not like I'm paying for the development of ICE, but it's just going into the government so that we can have all the things the government needs. And you just found another way to reach out and take some of my money. I'm okay for vehicle tax if it goes for the roads, but I'm not okay for a vehicle tax if it's just a penalty for owning a vehicle. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Stay right there. You are listening to the Noon Business Lunch on WGN. John Williams here. Incidentally, you heard Steve Alexander's story a moment ago about theft of these semis that are loaded with goods and they're stealing them across the country. This isn't a brand new thing. There's just so many examples that pop up. And earlier today here on WGN Radio, I heard the story about $400,000 worth of lobster, fresh lobster that was to be shipped from Massachusetts. The lobster fishermen catch it out in the Atlantic. They bring it to Massachusetts. From Massachusetts, it's put on semi-trucks, and it's on its way to the Costco's in Illinois and Minnesota. And the thieves, using fake IDs so that they present as subcontracting truck drivers, and then they've got burner phones and a whole network of, you know, artificial intelligence or stuff on the internet that makes them look real. They're not. But then they take the trucks full of the lobster and they don't deliver them. My question is, where does it go? The stories I've read doesn't say, all right, so what are you going to buy lobster out of the trunk of a car? Somebody's going to say, hey, kid, you want some shellfish? No. What do you do with that? Like if it's watches or tequila, well, yeah, you can sell that anytime, anywhere. You may have seen the 60 Minutes story. about how Guy Fieri and Sammy Hagar's Santo Tequila, and it was this very expensive bottle of tequila, and there was 40,000, I think, bottles of it on this truck or on these trucks. That stuff was stolen and eventually recovered. It's just fascinating, though. Okay, so enough about that. Let's get back to our guest, Elliot Richardson, president and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Just a couple more minutes, but what is the plan for the new year then, Elliot? Is there something you guys are working on or launching as you advocate for small businesses?
Yeah, you know, what we want to do, John, is push for a proactive agenda, right? So looking at the city of Chicago, and you and I have talked about really seriously cutting red tape, right? And unleashing entrepreneurs in Chicago to open and to grow their businesses. We're going to be pulling out all the stops on that this year. We think the timing should be right after what just happened in the budget, and everything from reducing the burdens of these special use permits, which really shut out a lot of small businesses from opening, to increasing in the consistency of inspections so small businesses aren't hit with inconsistent inspections and the costs involved in that, improving the debt check process. You know, these debt checks often penalize the wrong people. Folks get caught up in it. Like, there's a laundry list of things that we can do to proactively improve the business environment in Chicago, which will actually raise revenue for the city. And that's what we want, right? So when the budget comes around next year, instead of looking at all the different taxes and fees that need to be increased, perhaps we're able to raise more revenue by allowing businesses to make more money. So that is on the horizon for us at the city level, and at the state level and the federal level. Look, we got to try to stabilize health insurance premiums, and we have ideas about that. Yeah. We have reforms on that. I mean, there's so much on our agenda, but it's really, you know, small businesses do drive our economy. You hear politicians.
Are you hearing, Elliot, from small businesses that they are worried about the cost of their health care going up at the turn of the year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just, if you ask small businesses what their number one concern is moving forward, it is health insurance and the cost of premiums and the quality of care that they're going to get. And that just has not changed. I mean, it's year after year. So, you know, there's things like association health care plans that we'd like to look at, allow small businesses to pull together and through the power of critical mass, you know, negotiate some better rates. There's solutions out there. They got to figure out, John, this ACA marketplace, right?
Man.
And what's that's going to, right? I mean, well, what's going to happen to entrepreneurs there?
It's not just a Chicago issue. That's a federal issue, too. But Illinois is actually better positioned than some states to get through that. I'm out of time today, but Elliot, let's you and I talk again about this in the near future. Elliot Richardson is the president and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Good luck to you in the new year, Elliot.
John, thank you so much for having me on, and Happy New Year.